KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Before I go,
I want you to know,
it ain't so simple.
If you could see,
maybe you believe,
even just a little.
Program, ladies and gentlemen. It's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And that was the Cotton Mollies. I'll tell you a little bit more about them in just a minute, okay? But first, let me do my honors to Debbie Johnson, Free Range Radio Theater. Great stuff, as always. 10 o'clock, every Monday night, just before this program, an hour, Debbie does it up and brings you great radio theater every week. And tune in for that before this program, okay? Let's see, what else happens? Before that, Kelvin and Jason. Yeah, jazz plus blues equals rock and roll tonight, for sure. Tech radio, as always, interesting before the guys do the jazz and blues show. Jeff Wheeler starts things off with Uncommon Light every Monday from 3 to 5 p.m. Great radio on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be here with you and a part of it all. All right, thanks to everybody who listened and participated in the program last week. Big thank you to Judith Ann Brown, the author of John Marco Allegro, Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Judy, just a wonderful, good-hearted woman who happens to have a great gift to write and a great gift to write about as well, her dad, the amazing John Marco Allegro. So thank you so much, Judy, for doing the show last week. Only one regret, I wish the audio quality would have been better. Alas, you know, the best I could do. Like the scrolls, it must be teased out, apparently. All right, so anyway, someday maybe we'll get a transcript of it. Hint, hint, out there to those of you listening. All right, and regardless, I hope the message came through. Judy, awesome. And her father spoke what he felt was the truth for sure. So thanks a lot, Judy, for sharing with us. And we also heard some great live music from John Henry and the Engine, who I saw perform on Friday night, as a matter of fact, and heard some new stuff from ITOM Lab, my friends at ITOM Lab. Great stuff. You can hear it all if you missed it last week on the web, www.mikehagan.com, in the program archives. Go check it out for yourself and share it with your pals if you think you dig it. All right. All right, tonight, Dr. John Sheliak, nuclear physicist, mathematical genius, one of the grandfathers of the time wave theory, teased out of the I Ching nearly 36 years ago by my good friend and teach, Terrence McKenna. And if you didn't notice, once again, we have some live music for you here in the studio with me tonight, the Cotton Mollies. Want to say hi? Hi, everybody.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hi, y'all.
All right, and thanks to the Mollies for getting things going for us. We'll have some great music from them. We'll have some more in just a bit here, and we'll mix in some tunes later in the show as well. But what did we start out with, you guys? What's the name of that song?
That was Before I Go.
Before I Go. All right, well, we'll do some more before you go for sure. But anyway, back with the Mollies in just a minute. But all the music that we feature on the program, you can find information on the web as well at MikeHagan.com. Just click on over to the music archives, right? All right, so we have great stuff coming up. John Sheliak. Amazing. You know, Dr. John's never been on the radio before doing this sort of thing. So sort of an exclusive for us tonight. We'll talk about the time wave, Terrence, the relationship between those two, and how the whole thing came together back then in the 70s and through the 80s. And, you know, John works for Los Alamos now. And, you know, he's a celebrated physicist. But back in the day, he did some work that I think is probably more relevant than the stuff he's doing right now. That's just my opinion. But we'll have to see what he has to say about that. So anyway, Dr. John Sheliak coming up in just about 55 minutes or so. And we'll do the news. We'll do space weather coming up in a little while. I'll tell you about some upcoming guests. And we will have the Cotton Mollies play some more music for us. But first, I better say hello and find out who's who. Pardon me, who's who here? Because we've met sort of in a loud, dark bar a couple times over the last 3 or 4 weeks or so. And I've got everyone confused. We've been trading emails and stuff. But anyway, so first of all, ladies first. Over here on my right, this is mic number 2.
Hey, everybody. I'm Erin Dunleavy. I play viola and some vocals. My voice isn't shot.
All right, Erin. All right. Thank you for being here. It's great.
Thank you very much.
All right. On the bass.
I'm Brian Heffernan. I do, I guess, vocals and play Padunkadunk.
Padunkadunk?
Yeah, and the Padunkadunk is bigger than all of us in the room, by the way.
Very, very true. Yeah, I'm Rashad Statia, and yeah, I play guitar and I do vocals when I can.
The ladies.
And I do what I can.
Right? His girlfriend's listening.
Yeah,
so
my girlfriend
I should probably say Josh Wright, and I'm at Lindsay. I'm sorry, I'm the one who gets the ladies. And I play banjo and sing a bit.
All right, well, let's... let's do another one. We'll talk a little bit more about the band in a minute, but let's hear another song, okay? All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to KOPN Radio Orbit, 89.5 FM in Columbia, Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, outrageous talk, and music of the Mollies. Here you go, everybody. One more from the Cotton Mollies. It's Mike, Radio Orbit, back in just a few minutes, okay?
Shirley on the dance floor, thought he knew her well. Yeah, never in his life did he ever dream she'd be a three-year-old Southern Belle. So bring him on home, you bring him on home to his bed. You're busting up his heart, now you're busting up his head. Made him think he had a chance, instead he played dance with another. Yeah, bring him on home, you bring him on home to his head. You're busting up his heart, now you're busting up his head. Made him think he had a chance, instead he played dance with another man. He walked up to her and asked for a hand, unaware she had a man, riled up and ready for a fight. With one punch, the boy was out. Little Shirley began to shout, somebody better take that boy on home tonight. So bring him on home, you bring him on home to his bed. You busted up his heart, now you busted up his head. Made him think he had a chance, instead he played dance with the other man. Yeah, bring him on home, you bring him on home to his bed. You busted up his heart, now you busted up his head. Made him think he had a chance, instead he played dance with the other man. Shirley, girl, you look so swell. Your eyes are saying what your lips don't tell. He is buying what you had to sell. Now we feel in love. Shirley, girl, you look so swell. Your eyes are saying what your lips don't tell. He is buying what you have to sell. And now we feel in love. Shirley, girl, you look so swell. Your eyes are saying what your lips don't tell. He is buying what you have to sell. And now we feel in love. Shirley, girl, you look so swell. Your eyes are saying what your lips don't tell. He is buying what you have to sell. And now we feel in love. So bring him on home. Bring him on home to his bed. You must have started. Busted up his head. Made him think he had a chance. Instead he played dance with another. And bring him on home, you bring him on home to his head. You busted up his heart, now you busted up his head. Made him think he had a chance and said he'd play again with another. So bring him on home, 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 bring him on home. Up his heart, now you busted up his head. Made him think he had a chance and said he saw you dancing. And bring him on home, you bring him on home to his head. He busted up his heart, now you busted up his head. Made him think he had a chance and said he saw you dancing with another man.
All right, once
thank
again,
you.
Everybody, the Cotton Mollies. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Radio Orbit. It's about 12 minutes after 11 on the 26th of February now, 2007. And all right, so great stuff, you guys. Let's let's talk a little bit about the band. As always, you know, I go the Blue Fugue, and they don't pay me, and they ought to, but but I don't get paid by anybody. This is community radio, by the way, if the FCC is listening, okay? I don't get any money from anyone to do any of this stuff, all right? So, but I do go down there and listen to music a lot, and sometimes I hear stuff that makes my ears bleed, and sometimes I hear stuff that I go, wow, that was great. And so we ran into you guys, actually Will did, who's sitting here in the corner with his A&R look on. He saw you guys maybe a month or so down there. Monday nights is open mic night, and said, "Hey, there's these guys that do this great bluegrass thing." And then this was before the young lady was with the band.
Yeah, she wasn't able to play that way.
Right. And anyway, so I saw you then a couple weeks after, and then again 2 weeks in a row, and said, "Hey, we got to get those guys on the air. That's great." So tell us about the Cotton Mollies and where you come from and what's the deal with the band, because you haven't been around the scene for long. I know that.
Now we all just started getting together pretty much last spring, and off and on played a little bit together, and we're all from all over Missouri and Kansas City and St. Louis, came together in Columbia.
Yeah. Huh? You're all in school here or what?
Yeah,
we're all MU students up here, so. Josh and I, we started playing together last year, and then we just kind of ended up adding everyone after that. It just kind of fell into place, and, I mean, he just started playing the banjo, too, so, I mean, we've just been kind of, like, everything's been kind of,
probably about 3 weeks.
Now. Yeah, so, I mean, everything's just been kind of new changes, and it's been a lot of fun. So.
Backgrounds in music for any or all of you?
Well, I've been classically trained. I started playing viola when I was around 7 or 8, but I've just started playing. I kind of bluegrass is what I do, at least try to. Rashad made me listen to it. He's like, "You should try and play this." So, you know, I've tried my best. I've done some Irish fiddling in the past. So
yeah, great
trying
stuff.
To pick this up.
I love Celtic music. It's great.
Me too.
And very difficult. I mean, or technically challenging.
It is.
I guess.
A lot different than everything else. So. Yeah.
All right, and you on the bass?
I've been playing bass since I get about my freshman year of high school. I'm now a junior in college. So I've been playing in bands, I guess, for maybe 4 years now. I play in a group back in St. Louis called Johnny on the Jerks.
And, great.
What kind of music?
It's like rock and roll, blues, rockabilly, country punk.
Yeah, buddy.
I love all the new categorization.
Yeah. I don't know.
I know. It's impossible.
Punk,
but.
Yeah, it's a great side project, and, you know, I love doing this stuff. So.
All right. Well, cool. What about playing? I mean, are you just doing this for kicks? Or do you guys want to? Are you interested in doing music for livings? Or are you just here doing this while you're in school? And what do you want to do? I mean,
well, we were hoping you'd help us springboard then.
This is just for fun.
You give me way too much credit.
Yeah. it's just been so much fun, and people have given us such a good feedback that I just don't want to stop yet. You know,
yeah.
It's just
it's great fun music, and it you know, it gets people tapping their feet and smiling, and
especially in a bar.
Yeah, we've just been kind of riding the waves of this whole thing. I mean, we were playing the open mics at the Blue Fugue, and I mean, we kept getting the most positive feedback, and it just kind of encouraged us to start. I mean, we've been writing more and doing more.
As I look at Will again, I'm thinking, There is one gig I know you guys are going to do that's on May 4th.
Yeah.
And that's actually a KOPN benefit, and there's going to be five or six other bands that will be down there at the Fugue playing on a Friday night from 5 p.m. probably until they throw us out of there.
Yeah.
But that's going to be a great, great, fun night of music. And the Cotton Mollies, Caulfield and the Magic, In Thicket,
John Henry
and the Engine.
I don't think
the Feed, but we've got room for probably two or three more, and I'm sure that they're going to be great, great bands. So anyway, that's coming up. I know you guys are going to do that. Do you have plans to play anywhere else in between now and then, or are you just sort of getting things going around town?
We just heard from. Do you want to go ahead?
We're playing St. Patty's Day at the Fugue as well.
Right on.
I think we're playing around like 8:30 maybe in the afternoon or in the evening, and then go on again later at like midnight.
That's March 17th.
Right. Yeah.
What day is that?
Saturday, I think.
The 19th is a Monday. All right, so that makes sense. I do everything by Mondays because I know that's when I have to do the show. All right, well, take a break for a second, you guys. Let me do a couple things here, and we'll come back and play another song in a few minutes, all right?
Yep, great, thank you.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. It's the Cotton Mollies. We'll be back with them in just a few minutes here. Let me say hello, first of all, everyone listening to us this evening on KOPN over the traditional airwaves. Or otherwise, if you listen live over the web, every Monday we broadcast a show here from the studios at KOPN, 915 East Broadway in beautiful downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we also stream the show live on the internet at kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button and you'll get a nice 64K stream from KOPN. And you can also hear Radio Orbit every Monday night via the web. On Cosmic Waves Radio as well. That's a 24K stream, so if you've got a dial-up or a connection that's not real, you know, wonderful, just try that stream from Cosmic Waves, okay? Okay. Thanks to everyone, by the way, who makes it happen at KOPN and at Cosmic Waves, live and on the net. Thanks also to Larry, the web wizard, as always. Larry taking a little bit of a hiatus right now, but he'll be back with us very shortly. And thanks to everybody else out there who's been participating and helping out with the program, okay? There's also lots of people who are sending in music and art, by the way, and poetry and literature and all this stuff. And I encourage it and thank you. We have places on the website for all this stuff. And if you go there, just go over to Poets Corner. If you haven't been over there on the website in a while, there's a couple of beautiful poems that have been sent in over the last couple of weeks that are getting a lot of eyes on them, and I appreciate the people that are writing that stuff, okay? Regardless, the website is Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. You'll have access to everything we're doing over there. So take a look and see, and share your thoughts with me. The forum is cool. There's a bulletin board forum where there are lots of members that are busy posting interesting stories and ideas and opinions and whatnot up there, and then other people sort of sharing their own opinions and debating back and forth and discussing all this stuff. The forum's real cool, and I can't even keep up with the stuff that goes on over there right now, but it's worth taking a look. There's also a live chat room that's up every Monday night and up and rolling right now. I should peek in there, as a matter of fact, and see if, I guess I'm not that on top of it tonight because I haven't even logged in, so I'll do that in a few minutes. But anyway, the chat room's always up and active, and we'll peek in there for questions and comments from listeners who are listening over the web. And I encourage my guests as well as listeners to join us over there in the chat, because there's a lot of fun stuff that happens sort of in between the lines in the chat room there, okay? All right, so my email address, if you want to get in touch with me, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. Send email to me. Also send email to my guests. Also send email to my musical guests. By the way, do my musical guests have a contact information for us?
Yeah, we just set up a Gmail account, so you can reach us at thecottonmollies@gmail.com.
How do you spell that, Rashad?
It's it would be
how subtle.
It would be the CottonMollies @gmail.com.
All right, thecottonmollies@gmail.com. And what about a website? I think you just got a MySpace page started up or something.
Yeah, we got a MySpace page. We don't got any songs on there yet, but we will shortly. Our MySpace is MySpace. Go ahead.
It's myspace.com/thecottonmollies.
You mean that wasn't taken?
Surprisingly.
All right, so there you have it. That's the way to get in touch with those guys, okay? On the web, as I said before, MikeHagan.com, H-A-G-A-N, the phone number here in the studio. I'm not going to give it to you. You'll know it if you really want to get to me, I'm sure. And let me tell you a little bit about some upcoming guests here, and then we'll have another song from the Mollies. Tonight, as I said, Dr. John Sheliak, amazing stuff. And if you want to get a leg up, hop on the web and go over to my site and click on the link that says Dr. John Sheliak, and you can go over to his website or read the little synopsis that's underneath his bio and picture there on my site, and you'll see a little bit about what we're going to be talking about tonight. Next week, Dr. Ralph Metzner, one of the grandfathers of the, I don't know, the human potential movement, psychedelic movement of the 60s and the 70s, you know, was a professor at Harvard University with Timothy Leary back in the late 60s. Ralph Metzner, still doing great work, and now just sort of an icon in at least a lot of the fields that I'm interested in. So Dr. Ralph Metzner next week on the 5th of March, and we'll also have Noah Earle with us in the studio live. Noah will be playing some music and chatting it up with us a little bit. So that's going to be a great program next week, the 5th of March. It's an anniversary for a number of wonderful events, some of which are related to tonight, as a matter of fact, because John Sheliak, who we'll be speaking to in about 35 minutes or so, is involved in a very strange and synchronistic way to an event that happened on March 5th, 1971, in the jungles of Columbia. And I don't mean Columbia, Missouri. I mean Columbia, South America. And those of you who know what I'm talking about, I mean, of course, the experiment at La Chorrera, Dr. Dennis and Terrence McKenna back in 1971, taking a trip deep down the rabbit hole, of which we are yet to sort of emerge from, although it's coming. All right, on the 12th of March, Willie Gaspar will talk about the sun. And a little bit about the Mayan calendar as well, I think, but primarily Willie's interested in the sun. So we'll do a little bit of solar talk on the 12th of March. Not sure about music. We'll see. On the 19th, Dr. Jose Arguelles. Just stunned and privileged and honored to have Jose on the program with us on the 19th of March. You know, he just doesn't do this stuff. On the 26th of March, Eric John Phelps, author of Vatican Assassins, will address all of you conspiracy-minded folks and put your fears on supercharge on the 26th of March, all right? John Major Jenkins, as a matter of fact, I'm going to Colorado tomorrow. We're taking the family and just going to go to visit some friends and stuff in Colorado for a week, and I'm going to see John Jenkins. He lives not too far from Fort Collins, and I'm actually going to be going up to the reservation at Pine Ridge in South Dakota for a couple days, and on my way up there, me and my son Alex are going to stop and spend the night with John Jenkins and his wife in Fort Collins. So that should be real fun, and we got a lot to talk about. We're going to plan another show, and there are a few things that that we're just going to talk about personally, and it's going to be a thrill to be able to spend some time with John in the flesh, all right, and then get back up to the Black Hills, a place that I belong, you know. So Dennis, by the way, McKenna, doing well, and we'll talk to him when we talk to him. Paul Stamets, still working on that. Susan Weed, figure that one out for yourself. Barbara Ehrenreich, and believe it or not, I mentioned it last week, but maybe Dr. Jane Goodall. I know it's sort of a stretch for Orbit, but we'll see if we can get things worked out with Dr. Goodall, and I'd be, again, just absolutely honored if we could get her on the program. She's done amazing work for many, many years, and stuff that's relevant to all of us, although not enough people know about her. So, anyway, okay, a couple more minutes here. Let me take a few more seconds to say a couple of announcements, and then we'll have another song from the Cotton Mollies. Rudolf Steiner, one of my heroes, and just an amazing person who was around in the last century or so. He was born, as a matter of fact, on the 25th of February, 1861, as a matter of fact. So tonight, here's to Rudolf Steiner. If you don't know who he was a philosopher, actually born in like Croatia or something, but an Austrian philosopher and a writer and an esotericist, you know, a mystic of sorts, and founded this particular idea of thinking that they call anthroposophy or anthroposophy. And the thing that he did that I'm so interested in is called Waldorf education. It's a particular way of how we teach children, you know, the way the world works or whatever. But the Waldorf schools are something that have sort of just blossomed even after Steiner died in, like, I think he died in like 1923 or something like that. But anyway, Rudolf Steiner was great, and he was a total advocate of the individual, you know. And he came from the school of Goethe, Johann Wolfgang Goethe, you know, the German wonderful writer and philosopher that Steven Buhner has turned so many of us on to again. You know, Goethe and all these guys and girls from days gone by, this is where all the great work was being done. We're in the dark age right now. All the great stuff has been done. We just need to rediscover it. And guys like Rudolf Steiner and Johann Wolfgang Goethe, I mean, this is where it's at. So anyway, big time ideas from Rudolf Steiner. If you don't know him, check him out. Lots of information on the web, and if you do it, you'll be richer for it. Okay. And I mentioned that we have this benefit coming up for KOPN on the 5th of May, and I'm going to be barking that for the next 2 months. 4th of May, pardon me. Thank you for the corrections. Everyone's putting up four fingers and putting them in my face. So anyway, yeah, it's a Friday night, the 4th of May. We'll have the Cotton Mollies along with a number of other bands. And with that, let's do another song from the Cotton Mollies. And you guys can get a load of this. What are you going to play for us?
Follow Me.
Follow Me. We'll do it. Everybody, it's Mike with this Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Back in just a few minutes, this is the Cotton Mollies.
Baby's waiting for me, my baby.
baby's waiting for me. My baby's waiting for me to come home to her. I said, my baby's waiting for me. My baby's waiting for me. My baby's waiting for me to come on home to her.
But the Cotton Mollies again, everybody. Unbelievable. Great stuff. And by the way, you know, the logistics of this in a little radio studio is interesting to watch if you're hearing this over the web or, you know, over the radio, whatever. But I have a feeling it sounds great, but it's amazing here. We've got all four of them sort of jammed in here. We got sound bouncing off of every wall, three or four mics all open and just sort of ambient sitting out here. But anyway, it sounds great, and Just a great sound you guys have. Let's talk a little bit about who influences your music.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I got introduced to, like, Split Lip Rayfield probably, you know, a few years ago.
Sure. They were supposed to be here the other night, but they had to cancel for
something. Well, their guitarist just passed on recently.
Oh,
so, I mean,
they had cancer or something.
Thursday, yeah. So, I mean, we're all pretty, like, heartbroken about that.
Yeah.
And that was pretty hard. But, I mean, like, we're influenced by their music a lot. Yeah. A lot of
they're hugely influential on as far as me getting into bluegrass or speedgrass, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whatever
they're awesome.
Yeah. And, I mean, we listen to just a lot of old-school bluegrass stuff, too. I mean, whatever we can get our hands on.
Alison Krauss.
Lots of Alison Krauss at the time, you know, whatever we can hear. And we just started, I mean, we eventually just listened to all this stuff and just kind of developed our own sound, hopefully.
I'm a big fan of Johnny Cash, too.
Yeah,
Johnny Cash.
And the stuff you play a lot of original stuff. This is original
stuff. Yeah, everything we play is original. Tonight.
Me and Rashad bounce off some ideas.
Yeah, we're always
writing something,
doing something new. So
yeah, awesome. And you're all at school here, and you live relatively close to each other. How often do you practice?
About once a week at my house on Friday.
Yeah.
5 o'clock. No, we just pile in my living room and play around for about an hour or 2 hours or so, and then
go to dinner.
Yeah. And then you know, we get together, I guess, sometimes before we play the open mics on Monday.
Uh-huh.
But other than that,
about once a week then. Yeah.
Huh? Not a lot, actually.
No,
you have a great synergy between the four of you.
We're actually all connected by mind.
Well, there's something going on. I mean,
we're kind of a collective.
Yeah. The Borg.
Yeah.
I just watched Voyager, and I saw some Borg.
You gotta love it.
Yeah.
All right, you guys. We'll play another one here in a few minutes, but let me take care of some stuff, okay? All right, everybody, it's the Cotton Mollies. You can find them on the web at myspace.com/thecottonmollies. And also, if you want to get in touch with them via email, thecottonmollies@gmail.com. All right? Okay, let's see. What time is it? About 11:35. Let's do space weather real fast here. You know, NASA has this spacecraft that's on its way out to Pluto. It's called New Horizons. And another one of these wonderfully creative names from our friends at NASA. But anyway, it's going to zip by Jupiter very shortly. And the reason it does that is they use the planet as like a gravity slingshot. And the craft comes in and gets caught in the gravity well of the planet, and they're able to work the trajectory to such an extent that it doesn't get actually drawn into the planet's, you know, field. It actually just gets whipped around the planet, and then it comes out going a lot faster. And then they point it off, you know, to wherever else they want to go from there. It's a way they can move probes and stuff around the solar system without, you know, using a whole lot of fuel and energy and this sort of thing. So anyway, so on the way out to Pluto, New Horizons is about to visit Jupiter. And while it's there, it'll gain a little speed, but it'll also take some photos and, if we're lucky, we'll get to see some of that stuff. And, you know, go to the website, my place, or Kent Stedman, cyberspaceorbit.com. I'm sure you can see some of that stuff, all right? Okay, as well, there was an expected solar wind that hit the stream of the Earth's magnetic field just last night. And it was supposed to be sort of a significant impact on the magnetic field. And we're thinking that there were going to be big auroras, but it turned out to not be so, and it was just a, sort of a scattered aurora effect at best, and not a whole lot of activity up there in the north, and all the guys that were up there waiting to take great photos were disappointed, and so that's the way it goes. It's been like that for me ever since Comet McNaught left the, you know, the neighborhood. That was such a stunning thing to me, and I was just out in the backyard, you know, watching that comet. And, you know, it's actually still, you can actually still see it with the binoculars if you're in, well, I guess the southern hemisphere is the best, but if you go outside after sunset and look south, and you'll need binoculars or a small telescope. But even with binoculars, you can still see Comet McNaught. It's sort of green, has a green tint to it, and it's just, you know, cruising back on its way out of the solar system. All right? Okay, the 27th of February, what's going on? Bernard Liot, 110th birthday of Bernard Liot, 1897. This guy was a French astronomer and a mathematician. And he was an optics expert, though, and the reason he was sort of significant was because he was real interested in looking at other planets' atmospheres. And he was one of the first guys that got a look at Mars, and he recognized that the lunar surface, the, you know, our moon and Mars had things like sandstorms, which we now know happen pretty frequently. But this was a long time ago. This is 100 years ago, you know. Anyway, and in 1929... He developed the coronagraph, and it's something that we still use today. It's a device that we use to look at the sun, to look at the corona of the sun. And you can do, it used to be that the only time you could look at the corona of the sun was when there was an eclipse. But this guy figured out a way where you could do it, you know, anytime. So, again, one of these fellas that was significant back in the past, if you're interested in astronomy and physics and mathematics, Bernard Liot, 110 years old tomorrow, if he were still alive. All right, what else? Like I said, New Horizons is going to do a Jupiter flyby on February 28th. Asteroid Barringer getting close to Earth on the 1st of March. And let's see, on the 25th, actually on the 1st of March is the 25th anniversary of Venera 13. That was a Venus landing that the Russians did back in 1982. Been 25 years since that happened. And, you know, it's funny because people think about, you know, the planets and, you know, spacecraft and all this stuff, and it still seems sort of sci-fi, you know, to people, especially to younger people that didn't grow up in the sort of space age. You know, I grew up in the 60s and the 70s, and we called it the space age, right? Because everything was about going to space. Well, I mean, in 1972, they were landing probes on all these planets. No problemo. You know what I mean? No problem. And getting all kinds of fancy photos back and all this stuff. Now, it's 30 years later, people get all excited, you know, and they see a photo from Mars, and this is a crock of beans, because... You know, it's just the same old stuff they've been doing for 30 years. I just don't get it. Anyway, I always thought that by the time the millennium rolled around and by, you know, 2007, that we'd be on our way to the stars. You know, not still fighting over oil. You know, and this sort of thing. I thought burning dead animals and plants would be long behind us. You know, when I was 5 years old watching Neil Armstrong walk on the moon in 1969, I thought, hell, by the time I'm 40 years old, it's going to be to the stars, baby. I really thought so. And so far that hasn't happened. But you never know. Things can change really quickly. The technology these days is sort of difficult to predict what's going to happen. So anyway, lots of stuff going up in the stars above our heads, as always. Mercury, not very well placed for observation this month. Venus, our lovely goddess up there, beautiful this time of year, just brilliant in the evening sky, probably 3 or 4 hours after sunset, and it'll be that way all the way until we get to summer. And on the 29th, actually, on the 29th of this month, wait, there's not 29 days in this month, in March. That's what I meant. I should write my months down. But on the 29th of March, the moon will get real close to Venus, and it'll look real cool in the evening sky. And Mars, what's going on with Mars? Early morning in the east before dawn, if you want to see Mars, okay? And it'll be coming up maybe an hour before the sun. Okay, so let's have another song here from the Cotton Mollies. I'm going to get on the telephone and get my guest on the line.
Sure.
And we'll come back. I'll do a little bit of things, a couple things in the news that we can talk about. And then we'll have Dr. John Sheliak at the top of the hour. So that's what we'll do, okay? It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Let's see what we're going to hear from our friends here.
This song is called Caught on Molly.
All right. So much wonderful music, the Cotton Mollies, yeah. Everybody.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hey, no problem. Let's actually do that. We'll say goodbye, and I'll finish things off here in this first time. We'll have our guests come on at the top of the hour here. But it's been the Cotton Mollies, and one more time on the web at
myspace.com/thecottonmollies.
All right.
How do you spell that?
I think they know it by now.
That's the Cotton Mollies, yeah. MOLLIES.com.
Thank you very much.
Actually, the Cotton Mollies at MySpace. MySpace.com/thecottonmollies. There you go. Now that I really screwed it up and nobody will never find it. So, all right. And thecottonmollies@gmail.com if you want to get them by email.
Yeah,
all right, you guys. Wonderful stuff. Thanks. I hope to see you around, okay?
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, enjoy the night. All right, cheers. All right, everybody. That's the Cotton Mollies. And great, cool, kicking blue something grass and all kinds of different stuff mixed in there with the Cotton Mollies. And Will, thank you too, man. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, and it's about 11:45 now in the p.m. on the 26th of February, 2007. We'll have Dr. John Sheliak with us in just a short 15 minutes or so. And
thanks one more time. All right, see you, man. To the Cotton Mollies on the web, myspace.com/thecottonmollies. All right, and we'll link up there to them as well from mikehagan.com in the music section of the website, okay? All right, let's see. Let's go look at the news, I guess, and see what's going on. And we'll go snoop over the forum a little bit. What's this one here? A Million Trees. Nobel Professor Wangari Maathai visited the United States a few years ago. She met with a corporate group that said it planned to plant a million trees. She said that they had better plan on a billion trees because of the state of deforestation in the world and the need to rehabilitate the environment in order to combat global warming and climate change. Again, you know, I mean, sort of assumptions there, but I agree, you know, the more trees we have, the better. But I don't know if planting a billion trees will do it. Let's see what else they have. It is from the vision of Professor Wangari that the United Nations Environmental Program came up with for the plant for the planet, the Billion Tree Campaign, which is now in its third month. The campaign aims to plant a minimum of 1 billion trees this year. Yet even before the UNEP campaign was launched last November, there have been many tree planting activities the world over as individuals, schools and institutions, private sector organizations and local authorities implemented their own plans to plant trees. Yeah, I guess planting trees is good. But the problem that we have is the old growth forests. That's our biggest problem. You know, you can plant as many trees as you want, but when you don't have the elders of the forest, you know, there's a big gaping void there. You know, it's sort of like in any kind of culture, you know, if you replace all of the elder generation with babies, you know, and just load the place up with young, you know, babies and have none of the elder generation around, well, then information never gets transferred, you know, transferred from you know, from the older and wiser members of the species down to those who are still learning, or, you know, we're all still learning, but down to those who are, you know, have more to learn, let's say. So, you know, our problem isn't one of planting, we don't plant enough trees. The problem is we cut down trees without thought. You know, we kill living entities as if they were dead. This is the problem in general with many of the things that we do. You know, we act as if nature is dead and that we can just hack it to pieces and take what we like and leave what we like, and, you know, just, and there will be no consequences. Well, nature's not dead. You know, Sartre was wrong. You know, nature is not mute. Nature is anything but mute. Nature is, you know, the song of sirens. So, anyway, speaking of that, listen to this. Get a load of this, right? The Live Earth concert. You heard about this thing? Al Gore and the guy from Branson. What is it? Virgin Records, right? Environmental activists led by former Vice President Al Gore announced plans Thursday for a 24-hour pop concert across 7 continents in July to mobilize action to stop global warming. Oh, this is different than the thing that Branson's doing. They're doing it together, though, I think. That's the Live Earth Challenge, or the Earth Challenge, or something like that. You know, they're going to give a whole bunch of money to somebody who supposedly can find a way to sequester CO2 or to, you know, eliminate CO2 or to find a way to minimize CO2 or something like that. Here's an idea for Branson. If you want to minimize CO2, how about if you ground your fleet of 747s? How about that? That would maybe help things out a little bit. I don't know. Maybe I should send that in as my suggestion for the Earth Challenge. How about if we ground all the airliners that are dumping toxic jet fuel in the atmosphere every day? That's a catalyst for, you know, things like ozone depletion. You know, it's such a red herring, all this stuff, because there's no real effort, there's no real will to change any of this stuff. These guys are talking about, you know, you driving too much, when routinely gigantic, you know, jet aircraft dump fuel before they land just to lighten the aircraft. They do it every day. I used to live in Denver. I'm going to Denver in a couple days. I used to live there and, you know, just watch as planes would come into DIA and just dump jet fuel before they landed. Just dump it into the atmosphere. Why? Because they want to lighten the weight of the aircraft. And they pump them so full of fuel, you know, in case, you know, they have to circle for a while or something. You know, they got to have a lot of extra fuel in case they have emergencies or whatever. But, you know, they actually just dump the stuff in many cases, right in the sky. So, anyway, there you go. Good job, Al Gore. Good job, Branson, whatever your name is. What else we got here? Not that there won't be cool stuff. The concert's a cool thing because whether the intentions of the organizers are sincere or not, you'll get some great synergy in the crowd and you'll get some good music and hopefully some good ideas will pass hands. And hopefully someone with you know, some ingenuity will keep track of the money and find out where all the money goes and can make fun of them later, you know, when they see where it all goes. So, I don't know. What else? Oh, man, here's a sad one. Terrence McKenna. You know, we're going to talk with John Chelyak in just a few minutes, who knew Terrence. And anyway, Terrence's library was destroyed in a fire on February 7th. Listen to this. Very strange because I'll tell you something else in a minute. Listen to this. A five-alarm blaze erupted in an old building in downtown Monterey. The fire started in a Quiznos sub shop, the exemplar of tasteful dining, and went on to thoroughly destroy a number of joints, including Goomba's Italian restaurant, a Starbucks, and some storage offices belonging to Big Sur's Esalen Institute, ground zero for the human potential movement, and now an upscale New Age resort. Esalen lost little of their own archives. The vast bulk of their books, photos, etc., were residing elsewhere. Unfortunately, the Institute was also using the offices to store the amazing library of Terrence McKenna, the visionary psychedelic bard who passed away in the year 2000. The plan was to eventually install the books at Esalen, a place that Terrence loved, but which is hardly associated with scholarly pursuit these days. That plan will obviously never be realized. If you knew Terrence or enjoyed his library, the fire is a tragedy. Not simply because it consumed his private papers, but Terrence's library reflected the multidimensional facets of his own mind, mysticism, history, drugs, dreams, science fiction, systems theory, natural history, art. Terrence was a head who fed his head with books more than drugs. And the writer says, I will never forget the sheepish look he gave me 6 months or so ago before his death as he forked over a fistful of 20s for a copy of Empson's Cult of the Peacock Angel, a rare book on the Yazidis that he bought from an esoteric book dealer I knew. It was a look that said, please don't tell my girlfriend. Anyway, it's a shame. And you know, Terrence was of the spoken word, though, too. And his best work was of the spoken variety. And that stuff lives, and it migrates around this planet every day. And it's a sad thing what happened to his written works. And I talked to Dennis about it, and he said, yeah, it's gone. Dennis has some things, you know, of course. But there's a great library that's gone. But like I said, the most important things that Terrence was interested in, he said. And he said them over and over again. He said them really clearly. And if you listen to what he said and take his advice, you know, you might find a feather bed when you jump off the cliff, you know. All right, so it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Play a piece of music here from a project called Sorcerer, and you'll recognize it in a few minutes maybe, but this is my friend Jeff Kernett and one of his projects. It's Sorcerer on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Dr. John Sheliak.
You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
All right, it is Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. My guest tonight is a nuclear physicist. He's a master mathematician. He's a mystic of sorts. And the guy who put Terence McKenna's time wave novelty theory on firm mathematical ground. He's a modern-day shaman, and it's a pleasure and a privilege. Dr. John Sheliak, welcome to Radio Orbit. Thanks so much for being here with us.
You're very welcome, Mike, and I thank you for your gracious invitation to join you and discuss some of these ideas that I find intriguing and interesting.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled. And I have some sort of a reverb on the telephone with you.
Let me try this. Hang on. Can you hear me now?
Yes, Holiday? I can hear you much better. What was that, I wonder?
Oh, It's the headsets I was using.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, I think I'm going to ask you to forgo it for now at least.
I will, definitely.
All right, good. Well, we'll make it through. And, let's say hello. Thank you again. And background, for people who don't know who you are, we don't have to do a whole lot about you. There's a whole lot of other things to talk about. But just to give people a general framework of who Dr. John Sheliak is, maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got sort of where you are.
Sure. As I said, I think the details of my personal history are probably should be kept to a minimum.
Okay.
I think the more interesting things are the ideas.
I agree.
how I got to where I am, that's a big question.
Where are you now? Maybe we should ask people, are you willing to talk about what you do these days? I mean, it's been
a
while since the time waves.
Let me just give you a brief kind of summation of where I came from to where I am now in terms of lifestyle, work, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually born in Western Michigan.
Hmm.
That's where I spent most of my time in school, with the exception of Indiana University. I did undergraduate work at Indiana University in linguistics and then Michigan Tech, applied math and electronics, actually.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I went to the University of Michigan where I did my graduate work, nuclear science, plasma physics, and time-of-flight neutron diffraction work. And actually, it was while I was at Michigan that I really became interested in shamanism. Someone gave me one of Castaneda's books.
Carlos Castaneda, sure.
It's probably, in my view, the best, still the best written of the books that he wrote. But what was important about that for me was the whole notion of shamanism and what it was about, you know, the primacy and power of direct experience.
Mm.
You know, I had been a practicing Roman Catholic up until about that point, and the fact of the matter is, you know, the vessel of the Church, as well as it served me for as long as it did, you know, no longer contained the experience that I was having in the mystical dreamtime domain. So I really became very interested in exploring that, which I did,
mm-hmm.
Through Native culture in a variety of ways, which led me actually to the Huichol people in Mexico. Where I spent several years in a row kind of traveling there and exploring their brand of, you know, shamanic practice. And the fact is that after graduate school, I was actually kind of drafted, you know, into this small company, relatively small company that was doing fusion energy research.
That was doing fusion energy research.
Fusion energy research, laser fusion, which simply means using high energy laser beams to fuse isotopes of hydrogen, deuterium, tritium, and the two isotopes of hydrogen that are actually used in fusion research.
Mm-hmm.
And one way of doing it is high energy lasers. Actually, my site talks about that particular feature of my work and lifestyle and background. There's also magnetic fusion that uses, intense magnetic fields to confine the plasma. What fusion is really about is what happens, what powers the sun and the stars, and that is you put atoms of hydrogen in close proximity, heat them up, That means give them a lot of kinetic energy until they start banging into one another, you know, and with mm-hmm. enough energy they'll fuse and produce energy and helium as mm-hmm. a byproduct.
Right, right.
So anyway, from there, you know, it's sort of a working a dual path for me. My interest in science really comes, and physics comes from, I think, first and foremost, my fundamental nature as a mystic, and I sort of consider myself that, but there's not really much magical about that term for me, because we live in a cosmos that's absolutely teeming with mystery and wonder.
Right,
so one has ample opportunity to explore these deep unknown features of life and existence, and that's been a passion of mine as far back as I can remember.
John, let me give out the website real fast since you mentioned it. John has a new website, actually. It's, I don't know, probably, what, 50, 75% finished, I'd say. There's some stuff you're still going to add, and I'm sure it's a work in progress.
The outline is probably 50 to 75% finished. The details are going to be substantially more than that.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of a work in progress. The thing that I'm doing, it just never ends. It gets more and more... It takes on a life of itself, but the websites are just amazing, and it's so cool what you can do with them, you know.
It is.
So on the web, the website is K-A-I-L-E-H-S, and it's actually the word Shelyak if you write it backwards, K-A-I-L-E-H-S.home.comcast.net. And you can find that on my front page as well. You can link over there to Dr. Shelyak's site, and you can also, we got a couple threads up on the forum where we're talking about some of these ideas, and on the chat page, I'm sure, so not too hard to find your way over there, but on the web, one more time, K-A-I-L-E-H-S, it's Shelyak, backwards, .home.comcast.net. Okay, all right, so... So interested, obviously, in a lot of things, a mathematical background along with an open mind, basically. And, all right, so that puts you on your path.
Definitely. You know, and I should say along the way, I mean, basically, almost my entire life, in some sense, has been about, you know, exploring this domain between science, physics, and the mystical. You know, that's been intriguing for me as far back as I can remember. Long before I started hearing it from other people.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly there were a lot of others also interested in that along the way. So you see a lot of it now is interest in exploring the domain between science, physics, and the mystical.
Hmm.
Or the mysteries, the deeper mysteries of life, existence, the cosmos, and that kind of thing.
Stuff that was studied by our ancestors long, long time ago.
Absolutely, right.
All right, well, speaking of things that happened a long, long time ago, this book, The I Ching, was written a long, long time ago, and maybe one of the oldest books on the planet, I'm not sure, certainly an old, old book, 5,000-6,000 years for sure, and it's very strange. You know, John, we had another John on the program just a few weeks ago. His name is Jonathan Zapp,
mm-hmm.
John's great, and we actually did an I Ching reading on the air. It was really cool. We did a reading for Radio Orbit on the air. But I've been fascinated just on a personal basis with the I Ching for years, because I actually think it works, and I know that sounds silly because it's as occult as anything, you know, the tarot or the Ouija board or throwing the bones or whatever, but my experience is that that the I Ching works. So let's talk a little bit about the I Ching as much as you'd like to, and then we'll talk a little bit about the mathematics.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the fact that, you know, you make this comment that it works, and then you sort of hedge that by saying it sounds silly. But the fact of the matter is, you know, all of the one of the fundamental questions that I've had with any of this is, you know, can these things that we call oracles or whatever, are they set up, designed, connected, you know, with, you know, this larger process that we're all embedded in a way that would allow us to actually explore them and find correlations and connections with the more physical stuff that we think we have a handle on.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact of the matter is, and this comes from, you know, quantum mechanics, quantum physics, you know, we're embedded in a cosmic sea of information that links us with everywhere and everywhen. And who's to say how that sea of information manifests, you know, on planet Earth, certainly, in terms of the products that we create from our minds and imagination. Clearly, in some cases, I mean, you know, physics, you know, the ideas, theories, and all that are products of mind and imagination based on direct experience and perception.
Right. Everything we have, all of our fancy toys, our 747s, our buildings, our skyscrapers, our technology, it's all a product of the imagination.
Absolutely. As Terence liked to say, the meme, you know, ideas, memes. One can say, well, you know, where does this come from? Well, you know, we are in fact embedded, buried in this cosmic sea of information. And, you know, how that scales up to awareness, no one really knows, but more and more people are clearly taking the risk to say it somehow it does.
Right.
I mean, you have people like Dean Radin and, you know, the Egg Project that's going on at Princeton.
Right,
they're
right.
About, you know, making these connections between mind, matter, and trying to see if, in fact, you know, the quantum non-locality or entanglement actually works on the scale of human awareness.
Yeah, that project at Princeton's a fascinating one. I watch the egg sometimes, and the whole business of 9/11 was fascinating with regard to that whole thing.
Oh, sure.
You know, the random number generator and all that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The I Ching, back to it. When did you get introduced to the I Ching?
Oh, along the way, you know, just exploring the frontier, you know, which is where I really like to be. I like to be on the frontier, and that, you know, whether it be physical, emotional, mental, whatever. And it was one of the things that I encountered probably, you know, somewhere in graduate school, I guess it was. And it just intrigued me. It was, you know, one of these things that, you know, had features, you know, that it's mathematical features, you know, the layout of hexagrams, you know, the sort of binary nature of the hexagram, ones and zeros.
Right, right, right.
You know, the
broken
association
line,
with 64 codons. I was just a lot of things about it that were just simply intriguing to me. And so, you know, I started using it to see, you know, what in my experience, you know, could it actually give me information that I could say, you know, truthfully and honestly, you know, is relevant to my, meaningful to my life process.
Mm-hmm.
And more often than not, I found the answer to that question, yes.
Wow. John, you just mentioned codons. For people who aren't familiar with DNA and that sort of thing, what's the significance of 64?
64 codons in a DNA molecule, that, at least that we know of, in our DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how it's structured. I don't know a lot of technical detail about the structure of DNA, but I certainly do know that, you know, it has what are called 64 codons, you know, structured elements, proteins.
Right.
You know, that actually link, you know, I believe the spiral structure of the DNA.
Okay, and of course we have 64 possible hexagrams in the I Ching.
Correct.
Okay, all right. So, but please continue on about your experience with that book. So you were messing around with it in graduate school?
Yeah, I explored it, you know, and I found, you know, one of the things that one, you know, questions one should ask is, well, when you cast these things, you know, what's actually happening? You know, what's actually happening when you consult or cast? One of the features about the I Ching that I liked is that, you know, you do a lot of handling of it, you know, the throwing of the coins and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Paging through the book and reading here and then going there.
Right.
Yeah,
right. But it's like, well, you formulate something. You kind of get yourself into a state that's about what it is that you're trying to explore with it, you know, some kind of future state or present state in one's own life. You know, that's not unlike you know, as I said, you know, the equations of general relativity were, in fact, you know, although you're using high-powered, fast, big computers, you know, somebody sort of envisions, okay, what do I want to look at? What feature of the cosmos do I want to look at? And
right.
You have to put that input into these equations vis-a-vis the computer. It spits out, you know, an answer. Then you take that, interpret what that means in the context of what your question was or what you were intending to do. For me, the I Ching is somewhat similar. You know, you know, have this intention, this an idea, this notion of what it is that I want to explore with it. Cast, you know, the coins, gives you an answer that's based on the theory meaning, you know, what the hexagrams actually mean and how they're interpreted. You know, that's sort of the structure of the theory. So then you consult that to see what that means, and then compare it to one compares that to what one knows about one's life,
mm-hmm.
one's life process.
Right.
You know, and it's either resonant with it, you know, or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's either correlated with it or it's not. And, you know, certainly there's this element of, am I willing to actually be open enough to what this is saying and honest enough with myself to acknowledge that, in fact, that's happening in my life.
Right.
There's certainly that element. But, you know, people have this notion that somehow science, you know, is free of that kind of bias.
Hmm.
Fact is, it's not. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, people practice science with all kinds of biases and constrictions and, you know, strange notions and whatnot. What makes science a powerful tool, and what it has made, is because, you know, then you've got to get these ideas out and let other people take pot shots at it, and that sort of, over time, you know, takes out the fluff, the peripheral, and kind of gets you, ideally, distilled down to what's some kind of basic truth.
Okay.
That isn't present with one's personal use of the I Ching, but it could be, you know, if as Terence, I think you believed and said, you know, it's not like an oracle, or, you know, it's not some kind of, you know, parlor game. It's a science that we don't understand.
Mm.
You know, I don't know if that's true, but I think it's an interesting statement, and certainly no one can argue that it's not true, you know, at this point.
When how did you meet Terence?
Well, that was an interesting process for me.
I can't imagine.
Well, first thing, you know, it was early 90s. I just moved to New Mexico, where I started to work out here, actually, you know, doing fusion research here. And I had this close friend who lived up in the mountains north of Las Vegas, New Mexico. And I went out to visit her and her partner, you know, one weekend. It was a nice retreat for me. And she happened to have some Bacana tapes, so she pulled them out and put them on. And I was just absolutely fascinated by it. It wasn't so much what he was saying, but just the fact that there's a connection I felt with him in how he expressed himself or where he had come from. And I later sort of convinced myself that it was something like this. I know, I think that people who especially have a shamanic nature and are exploring the deep unknowns of life and existence, they go into the realm of the mystery.
Hmm.
And when they come back, they have an imprint. Something about them, you know, for me, tips me off that these people have been there. You know, and as I was listening to him talk, I had that, got that distinct impression that here's somebody who's been there. You know.
Yeah.
And
that's for sure.
And I really wanted, in more ways than one, and I really wanted an opportunity to be able to talk to him in person. And at the time, I had no idea how that would be possible. But a couple of years, maybe a year later, I think it was, I got this call from a friend who lives in Denver.
Right.
And she said, did you know that Terence McKenna is going to be here this weekend in Boulder and
mm-hmm.
going to do a weekend thing? I said, no, right. I had no idea. But I'll be right up. So I virtually dropped everything. I think she called me on like a Thursday or Wednesday. And this thing, you know, was to begin on Friday evening, and dropped everything and basically headed up to Boulder
mm-hmm.
and did this weekend thing. And, you know, the whole weekend was interesting. I mean, the Friday evening talk and, you know, the what he called a workshop, his basically discussions of, you know, the shamanic path that he...
Right, he loved to do the question-answer thing.
He was interested in. Mm-hmm. But he also, you know, last day started talking about his novelty theory and the time wave notion.
Mm-hmm.
And as he sort of laid this whole thing out, it was intriguing to me because I thought, well, this is interesting. If in fact the I Ching, if it can be argued the I Ching can be correlated with elements of, you know, of nature and the physical universe upon which we make measurements, then one should be able to test that in specific ways. I mean, if it's being expressed mathematically, one should be able to test that. And I thought that, well, you know, if this is really real, if he's onto something, it has to be expressible in more complex terms than simply the ebb and flow of a quantity he called novelty.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have a simple XY graph that's either increasing or decreasing. So novelty is either increasing or decreasing, but it doesn't say anything specific. It's just some general ebb and flow of novelty.
Right. You don't know what's going to happen. You just know the sort of level of what's going to be happening.
Right. You know, but in my work every day, I use mathematical tools that actually can kind of extract information from waveforms like that.
Hmm.
It's comparable to, you know, you look at the sun. The sun has, you know, radiation output, but you can't, with your eye, see anything specific. You know, it's just a general kind of thing that we get, light and whatnot, heat.
Mm-hmm.
But you can actually, you know, take a spectrograph and actually get information about the specific types of elements that are present, you know, and in what quantity in a star or the sun. Well, you can actually do the same kind of thing mathematically with any kind of waveform, you know, and...
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, you know, if this thing, and also what you have with this whole idea of novelty, you have, you know, a very general drift of this graph into novelty or out of novelty, or, you know, increasing novelty or decreasing novelty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Terence called decreasing novelty habit.
Habit, right.
But in fact, it's either increasing or decreasing.
Right.
You know, there have to be, my idea was there have to be all kinds of processes happening on the planet. You know, some are novel at any given moment, others aren't.
Hmm.
You know, some have large impacts on the civilization as a whole, some have small. These are all interacting and creating, you know, interference patterns of one kind or another. And what they end up with is creating a graph, you know, such as Terence basically created through his extraction of certain mathematical features that the I Ching exhibit.
Yeah, now that's something I want to ask you a little bit more specifically about. The time wave itself, the novelty wave, this fractal wave form that you're talking about, that we're going to talk about analyzing, it actually came from some sort of a proposed mathematical formula or algorithm that underlied the I Ching somehow?
Yeah, there are two, you know... If you want to look at the mathematics of what Terence did, Terence and then I think Peter Meyer, I don't know who else was really involved with developing that, but there are two distinct phases, you know, with that. The first phase, basically what he does is he takes the number of lines that change as you move from one hexagram to the next
mm-hmm.
in the King-Wen sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So from hexagram 1 to 2, for example,
mm-hmm.
all six lines change. So you write that number 6 down. Then you go from 2, you know, to 3, you write that number down. So what you end up with fundamentally first is a 64 number set. And then for reasons that, you know, I think from what I heard him talk about was that, you know, this experience that he and I think, you know, Dennis had in the jungles,
right.
Basically is where some of the information he received telling him possible ways of exploring, you know, these ideas that he somehow assumed were related to the I Ching. I don't know enough about the details of that.
That was the first order of difference that began that thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know the details of whether initially, you know, what he heard, you know, the vision that he had was actually how specific it was, you know, relative to the number sets in the I Ching. But the fact of the matter is, he settled in what he called this first order of difference, or the number of lines that change as you move from one hexagram to the next, from hexagram 1 through hexagram 64. Then, for whatever reasons, you know, he decided that, you know, that should be some sort of a dual or bidirectional wave. So he took that number set, inverted it, and, you know, then overlaid it on the original number set that gave him a bidirectional wave.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the simple way that he created. Then, and I think somehow related to this vision, he said, okay, you know, what does I Ching consist of? Okay, it consists of three fundamental parts in his view. You have the whole hexagram, that's one, you know, the entire hexagram. You have two trigrams, you know, each having three lines. You have a whole hexagram that has all six lines, and then you have individual lines. And so he sort of developed this time wave based on those three features. So you have initially one set of numbers that you basically, this bidirectional wave is like one line of a hexagram. You add six of those together and you get, you know, a hexagram.
Right.
Or you add two parts of three together and you get the trigram. Basically, that was all kind of added together and he did some funny things with it that I'm not sure why or where that came from, and it actually led to this half twist thing that Matthew Watkins spotted and said, hey, look, you know, explain this because it doesn't make sense mathematically,
mm-hmm.
or abandon your theory, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But fundamentally, it's the first order of difference that was expanded into basically this basic 384 number set,
mm-hmm.
through this individual trigrammatic and hexagrammatic feature of the I Ching. Basically, it's like taking a magnifying glass to, you know, the smaller number sets and magnifying them in certain ways and then adding the numbers together.
Mm.
That gave you his basic number set. That was the first part, and it's really that part that I worked on. That's where the flaw was. It was in that first part, because there were a lot of things that were done, a lot of assumptions that were made, some of which I don't know today, you know, why they were made, but they were made. And so my interest was, okay, let's, if we're going to be able to, you know, have any kind of discussion or dialogue about this, the mathematics at least have to be on a sound basis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My interest was doing just that with this first part, mathematics. The second part involved what in the book was called a fractal transform. I've since looked at that, and it's really I wouldn't call it more a fractal expansion. You know, it's deliberately done to create a fractal. But I only at that time worked on the first section of that.
Okay. Yeah, the for people who are unfamiliar, I guess Terence was a scientist of sorts, but he really wasn't a professional or a theoretical mathematician or anything like that. So I think he was having difficulty getting a fair shake. Is that fair? In other words, people were saying, "Well, look, we can shoot holes in your theory, therefore we shouldn't pay attention to you." And you were able to help solve some of those problems, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the idea, you know, I think, you know, Matt, as I said in the paper, I think Matthew did the whole enterprise an amazing service by doing what he did.
Right.
But he also drew some conclusions that I think were not warranted by what he did. He basically said, look, he made some mistakes here. These things don't make sense. And they reflect, they change your number set entirely. They change the number set, they change the theory, therefore, you know, just abandon the theory because then it doesn't make sense.
Mm.
I wasn't sure, you know, I mean, when I, what really happened during this weekend in Boulder, you know, at the end of the weekend I said, Terrence, you know, I have these, I'm fascinated by what you're doing here, but I want to be able to explore it in greater detail, and there's some tools that I can use to do just that. So he actually put me in touch with Peter Meyer,
mm-hmm.
who actually wrote the software and did the second half of the math, which is the fractal transform, as he calls it, so that I could actually, you know, have Peter modify the code so it would be user-friendly. You know, this is the early 90s, and didn't have the kinds of technology and tools that are available now, so I really needed him to make some modifications in that so I could, you know, explore it with the tools that I wanted to explore it with.
Yeah,
so he did.
I remember the early phases of the software where it was, I mean, it wasn't even Windows. I guess it was a DOS-based thing,
yeah,
the one
DOS.
That I remember.
It still is.
And I remember you know, it was amazing that the personal computer sort of was evolving at the time, though, because early on in the 70s and in the 80s, you know, Terrence and Dennis were, you know, making graphs by hand, you know, trying to do this stuff literally by drawing graphs. And the personal computer made obvious advances in how quickly and accurately you could get that stuff done. It was a miracle that it happened when it happened.
Well, I think it is. It's a testimony to just how, you know, sort of innovative, bright, and skilled, you know, Terrence was, even in areas where he had no expertise or no day-to-day experience.
Mm.
I mean, able to put something together in the way that he did was pretty amazing, even though he did make some mistakes. But hell, you know, you know, they make mistakes. I mean, string theorists make mistakes.
Sure.
You know,
this
is not news,
right,
for God's sake. I mean,
right,
anybody who thinks that any scientist, physicist goes through their, you know, routine knowing exactly what they're doing every step of the way is delusional. You know, it's not the way it happens at all.
Yeah.
You know, so one of the, you know, things that I found difficult to kind of, you know, handle at the time is all of this criticism about, you know, the theory just based on the fact that it didn't look palatable, didn't look like something that people wanted it to look like.
Mm.
And I pointed out in my paper, I said, look, you know, I mean, black holes have been predicted by theory for a lot of years, and there were, you know, if anybody talked about it, it was laughed out of the conference, you know, until the 60s. And all of a sudden, and even today, even more so, that, you know, they define the frontier of, you know, astrophysics and cosmology.
Hmm.
So,
yeah, amazing.
You know, it's how well they work that counts, you know, and, you know, so I wanted to explore that, and, you know, I got going on it, and I started, and I got off on other things. I don't know what happened, and then I decided along the way I want to get back to it, so I went to Terrence's site, and there was Matt, you know, Watkins' criticism. So I said, oops.
Now's your chance.
If I'm going to engage myself in this, I better, you know, look at this and see if he's right, if, you know, because I don't want to waste my time. So I did, you know, and I found the mistakes. He's right. But I also saw there were ways of correcting that. I mean, just to formalize it rigorously, mathematically, was a way to kind of correct for that. I had no idea at the time, nor did Terrence, and, you know, I have to really, you know, I admire Terrence, and I, you know, compliment him on his willingness to open this up to some serious investigation, because, you know, the result of what I did could have been, you know, this is crap, Terrence, you better abandon it. You know, turned out differently, though. It turned out, well, sure, it changes the number set, but let's look at what effect that has on what he is saying about this theory. You know, I had my own ideas. I still really wanted to explore it in much greater depth because, you know, I wanted to develop the tools that would actually reveal features that would be unambiguously, you know, either, you know, an affirmation, a confirmation, evidence, or against or for this having some bearing, some real bearing on reality.
Amazing. All right, John, that's a good place to take a break, okay?
Sure.
All right, let's do it, everybody. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Dr. John Sheliak. You can find information about John and the work that he's doing on the web at kaileh.home.comcast.net. That's the word Shelyak spelled backwards, kaileh.home.comcast.net. And you can link over there from my site from here on out, okay? All right, it's Mike, and it is Radio Orbit. We'll play a piece of music here. I'm going to mix it up a little bit tonight. I want to hear a song from my friends from Brooklyn, New York. This is Ism. The song is called Out of the Way. We'll be back in just a few minutes. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. Stick around. We got more with Dr. John Shelyak in just a few minutes. All right, that's Ism. The song is called Out of the Way. That's from a CD called Monkey Underneath. In my top 10 for 2006, for sure. And, all right, it's Mike, and you listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. What is it, about 12:45 almost, in the AM now, on the 27th of February. We've got Dr. John Sheliak with us on the line from his place in New Mexico, Santa Fe, I guess, thereabouts, right, John?
That's correct. I live in Santa Fe and make the trek up the hill, as they say.
What's up the hill?
Los Alamos.
Los Alamos.
That's
where you make a living these days.
The question that you asked me a long time ago that we digressed from is actually currently I'm working, and this is on my website. It's part of the section that's, you know, the science and math section. But I actually am part of a program that's called HAPL, which is High Average Power Laser Program. It's a program that's been set up multi-laboratory, industry, university program that's been actually set up to design an actual fusion energy power plant.
What does that mean to us?
That means if such a plant is built and becomes operational, we have a source of energy with
like the
term,
sun?
The term inexhaustible doesn't appeal to me so much, but since it uses essentially hydrogen or isotopes of hydrogen, we have a nearly inexhaustible source of energy, at least into the foreseeable future, that doesn't have, it's a nuclear process. However, you know, there are several features about it that are different from fission. With fission, you have a heavy nucleus, uranium, that you fragment. It's something like taking a hammer to a crystal ball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it comes apart in fragments.
Right.
Releases energy, but all those fragments are typically toxic and long-lived radioactive.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to figure out what to do with them. Another problem, you know, you're putting this pile of uranium together, and it just fissions away, and you have to design very sophisticated control systems to keep it from running away.
Right, right, right.
Fusion, on the other hand, you're injecting tiny pellets into a fusion reactor at anywhere from 2 to 6 a second.
So you can determine how much you feed it.
Exactly. You know, you have to, it's even more interesting than that. You inject this thing at 1,000 G's into the center of a reactor where it has to arrive at the same time that a multi-beam laser has to arrive, pulse has to arrive. So you can see all your systems are designed to keep this going. If anything fails, the whole process stops.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the byproduct is helium, effectively. You do produce neutrons, which are the energy-carrying particle, but you're not producing all of this nasty, radioactive, long-lived radioactive product.
Mm-hmm. How much helium?
How much helium?
I mean, loads of helium, or
how much helium is? Well, it's.
I mean, I just wonder what all the helium will do. That's Will we all start talking like Donald Duck? You know,
oh, excuse the helium, right? Yeah, right. Yeah, that's actually, you know, just have this little siphon. We siphon all off, you know, into these cylinders, you know, that, you know, people use to fill balloons and. Talk funny.
Well, okay, but I mean, essentially, we're talking about like the power of a sun, basically, or at least
that's
that,
it,
right?
Of course, we are. Yeah, it's
right.
The same. It's the same energy source that powers the sun and the stars, and you know, so HAPL's been set up to kind of design such a plant and then look at all of the engineering and physics issues that. Are yet to be resolved.
What's the scale of this that we're talking about? I mean, you as a person who's been in this field for so long, I mean, feasibility and, you know, time frame.
Well, the plant, I think, provided everything goes smoothly, it's like 20 years in terms of it being built. In other words, a prototype plant planned to be built in 20 years. However, there are some caveats here, you know. One is what's actually happening right now at in in Livermore, at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in Northern California, and that's something that's called NIF, which is the National Ignition Facilities. But right now, the largest laser facility, fusion facility, on the planet. The French are also building something comparable, but it won't come online until a number of years afterwards. And, of course, to date, we haven't achieved ignition. In other words, ignition means that you're getting more energy out than you're putting in the form of laser energy. NIF has been designed to produce ignition. And so, you know, everyone, of course, is waiting to see what will happen with NIF. Not waiting, but, you know, that's going to be basically the showstopper.
Right,
or not.
Right.
If NIF is successful, then, you know, the HAPLO program just proceeds and we move on to designing or, you know, building a prototype fusion power plant.
Amazing. Wow, okay, so you've got a lot of interesting things going on. I mean,
that would be an understatement.
Yeah, yeah, and we're only 45 minutes into the show.
Oh,
here,
absolutely.
People, so.
You know, I say this so many people. I said, if you're bored, there's something wrong, because there is not a shortage of interesting things that one in this universe that one can engage in.
Isn't it the truth? It's so funny. I get this one print magazine called New Scientist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty good magazine, but it's interesting because it comes out every week. In other words, I was astonished by that because I thought I was going to get it every month, and it started showing up every week, and I realized that the publishers were pretty much on top of it, and they realized that even then they're behind the times by the time they go to print. I mean, things are changing so quickly.
Absolutely.
In so many different areas. I mean, basically every area of endeavor, it seems like.
And I think, you know, any one of us that's sensitive don't have to be all that sensitive anymore, because it's like Terrence, I love this expression of his, a runaway freight train on a dark and stormy night.
Boy. Yeah, yeah.
And it's palpable, I think, in the lives of any of us, you know, this sense of acceleration.
Yeah, and more sort of an out-of-control situation. I think the people that like us to think that they're in control or under control of things are more and more being shown to be really having very little control.
Well, absolutely. That's why you see what I would characterize as desperation parts of people who, you know, have enjoyed this sense of control for such a long time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But as Terrence, again, I like quoting this one from him, you know, being out of control is the hopeful element. After all, whose control is that out of?
Right. Yeah, you and me.
You and I never had control to begin with.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's a good thing for us if no one's in control, certainly.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more now about this time wave then, because, you know, we're sort of alluding to things just in our sidebar here about how things are moving quickly and technology is advancing and things are going wild and wacky.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that apparently is predicted by the time wave. And, you know, we're starting to have sort of a better picture of what's going to be coming. And we have a little bit of hindsight now, you know. We can see where it was and where we are now compared to where it was, you know, when it sort of was sort of birthed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of it? Let's talk a little bit more about the time wave itself. I mean, forget about – we've talked enough about the mathematics, I think. People know basically the story. It's basically a legitimate mathematical theory now.
Well, mathematics certainly are on sound ground mathematically. There's no doubt about it.
Okay, so why don't you expand on that just before we leave the mathematics, a little bit more about the math and why we should be paying attention maybe.
Well, you know, my interest, let me back up a little bit. My interest initially was really exploring the details. In other words, I wanted to find some signature in this whole notion that said to me, aha, there's something real going on here, and it's extraordinary. Or, you know, this is really not going to be, at least in our present state of consciousness awareness, correlatable to anything that, you know, we can experience in life in the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
So my interest was actually doing that, and when I went back to Terence's site to kind of continue this, that was my intention, you know, and I had some ideas about how to do that, and, I mean, my idea, feeling, and sense still is that if this, in fact, is real, in the sense that you can correlate it with real experience, with direct experience, then you should be able to find features or signatures of real physical phenomena that appear here. And there are a variety of ways of doing that. And I think the way the whole thing is structured, you know, for people who haven't seen it, is that it's essentially a fractal waveform, which means it has self-similar properties that you can magnify any given section, and that magnified section looks the same as the unmagnified section,
mm-hmm.
all the way down as far as you want to go. And in addition to that, it's a fractal graph waveform that is decreasing over time. And that means that if you start with the earliest known history of the planet, you have a wave value that's fairly high, large number. And by the time you get to what's considered the end of this, you know, it's become zero. And for whatever reasons, and I don't know the details of it, Terence and whoever else was involved at the time decided that this zero point was going to be correlated with the end of the Mayan calendar. I think they actually came up with that early on before they actually knew it was the end
of
the Mayan calendar.
That's true.
And then they had to make some minor adjustments, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty phenomenal in itself. It's
remarkable.
Happen.
Yeah.
But I... So you have a fractal waveform, you know, that at any scale looks very much the same, that is decreasing to some point, which is zero. And that was one of the features that really intrigued me initially when, you know, during that weekend in Boulder. It's like, what does this mean? I mean, it's some kind of singularity here. And one of the first questions I had for mm-hmm. Terence was, what's the meaning of, you know, the zero crossing here?
Mm-hmm.
Because that was intriguing to me that you'd get this, some kind of singularity at the end of the wave, and what does it mean?
John, let's talk really quickly just about novelty in and of itself, sort of a simple definition for novelty.
Yeah, you know, one of the, you hear all kinds of criticisms about this, and one of the, you know, that I've seen recently on the net is that, well, novelty is relative, you know, what's novel to one person is not to another. Well, Terence actually, and I think this really came from an idea he had and an expression he had because that I borrowed and I expanded on it. Now, it's going to sound complex and a little bit arcane initially, but I'll explain what it is. And because I think one has to have some kind of specific, clear definition of novelty to actually be able to explore this.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
And I think I've heard you talk about it, but it goes something like this. You know, it's, you know, if you look at the cosmos from what we think the beginning is to where it is now, what you see is increasing complexity, increasing interconnectedness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the process can be described as, you know, the creation and conservation of increasingly higher ordered states of complex form, meaning that the universe is becoming more complex, more integrated, more interesting as time moves forward. So how does that manifest on planet Earth? What can you consider novel under those circumstances? You know, and I think it's the things that are part of life and life process that are about increasing integration, higher ordered awareness, consciousness, expansion of consciousness, any of the features that are part of our life process that add dimension, mm-hmm. you know, to that experience and that process.
Right. Well, wow, there's a lot of things fall into that category these days.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's one of the things that was never really done, you know, early on way, but let's try to define some of these things. Because the interest was more in the general features of it. You know, things are becoming more novel. And I think Terrence also, and I remember him saying something about this, you know, had a sensitivity to the fact that some people would think, well, this, you know, what happens to free choice if this thing, you know, is predicting what the future is going to be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know. And I've forgotten what his answer to that was. But I think, you know, there are many ways you can look at it. And the fact is that you can pick a process. You can pick something. For example, general and special and general relativity. Let's pick those, you
okay.
know, sort of scientific discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would they show up, you know, in such a way? You know, could they be considered something that actually adds or is resonant with this more universal or cosmic process that's about higher order integration? That means coming together, integrating, and operating more as a whole as opposed to individual parts.
And
when I say integration, that's what I refer to.
Okay, and again, for clarification, what we're trying to do is sort of map historical events and get an overlay over the novelty curve or the novelty wave and see if where we get a best fit, to see if we can get a fit somewhere so we can actually say, wow, the novelty graph actually does seem to follow along with Earth events or something like that.
With certain things, you know, I mean, look, the problem with trying to go event by event and looking at the general, for example, you can sort of convince yourself, let's look at general relativity, for example, or special relativity, that when those happen, the graphs, in fact, are moving in a novel direction. Now, can you say that, well, is that because of,
right.
of the proposal of general or specific, or, you know, special relativity?
Right.
Don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But let's assume that, and also there are other processes. For example, general relativity, there was World War I happening.
Right, right.
In my perspective, that's habit.
That's a habit, yeah.
You know, that's something that's just same old, same old.
Mm-hmm. Back to the
know.
War and back
yeah.
to fighting. Right, right, right.
And so I would expect that to sort of pull the wave in a more habitual less novel direction.
Right. So it's
what if both are going on at the same time? What
mm-hmm,
happens?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, as in other signals, the one that's most prominent, or the one that is most significant in terms of its alignment with this more cosmic process of higher order integration, should have, you know, a fairly strong influence. And what you see happening during that period of time with the general wave is that you see this kind of tendency to go more novel, and then because the war sort of takes over, then things become less novel.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, and this is where some of the criticisms come in, people can argue, well, you know, that's how do you choose which is influencing what, and, you know, what's really going on?
Right. Well, I tell
my
you
first
what.
Idea was let's try to pull out specific information.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with Fourier analysis, but
I have a mathematics degree, believe
yeah,
it or not.
Right. Okay.
So I'm very unfamiliar with it. No. I know enough to get myself in trouble, but yeah, I remember working with them.
Yeah. Well, see, basically, it's very simple. What Fourier analysis does is it says you can take any graph, let's say an XY graph, a signal that can be plotted in an XY graph as having a certain shape, like the time wave.
Right.
You can deconstruct that into a series of sine and cosine waves
mm-hmm.
at different
mm-hmm.
amplitudes and frequencies
mm-hmm.
and phases relative
mm-hmm.
to one another. In
mm-hmm.
other words, you can take, say, two sine waves, and for those who don't know what a sine wave is, it's this, you know, little waveform that kind of oscillates in a positive direction, negative direction. It kind of just sort of, it's usually a sine wave is used, you know, to sort of be symbolic of any kind of waveform. And, you know, you can add these sine waves together if they're at different amplitudes and frequencies, and you can actually reconstruct any kind of signal with a proper number of sine cosine waves at different frequencies and amplitudes. But what that saying is that you can extract specific frequencies from that complex wave. In other words, you can go backwards. If you can create a wave out of sines and cosines, you can find out which sines and cosines are in that wave if you go the other way around.
Mm.
And you can say that, okay, say I have a sine wave at a certain frequency and amplitude. What if that represents major scientific breakthroughs? You know, if you see a sine wave coming out that has a specific amplitude and frequency and phase relative to other components, what if that represents some major scientific breakthrough? Okay, we'll say, we'll pick that. And then we'll look at another period in history and see if it shows up again.
Right.
You know, and if it does, you know, that becomes interesting evidence that there may be something going on here.
Okay. All right, look, we're top of the hour. We've got to take a little bit of a break here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll come back and talk more. Everybody, John Sheliak, Dr. John Sheliak, thanks so much for being here. You can find information about Dr. Sheliak on the web at http://www.kaileh.home.comcast.net. And you can link over there from my site from here on out as well. We'll have Dr. John back in just a few minutes here. In the meantime, let's play a piece of music here. I haven't heard this one for a while. It's a band called Revolve. I played them a month or so ago, but... Anyway, great stuff. We'll hear it again here. This is called The Aquarius Initiation. We'll come back with Dr. John Sheliak in just a few minutes. Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. That's Leading from the Aquarius Initiation. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. On the web at kopn.org and streaming these days around the world. All right, and hearing us around the world are lucky people because we get to talk with Dr. John Sheliak. And, John, thanks for sticking around with us.
You're welcome, Mike.
All right, hey, look, okay, so before the break, we're talking about you basically saying, okay, there should be a way to sort of parse this thing out and find out if it's legitimate or not. So let's continue along that line.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think there are tools that are in place that one can actually use to examine these features. It's not an easy task, you know. And, you know, the fact is, and I think Terrence really appreciated that. I mean, if in fact this has some bearing on reality, there's something real going on here, then it's probably the work of a lifetime to explore it. Mm. You know? So, you know, given the fact that I don't have my entire lifetime again, at least this one, you know, to do it, what can I do, you know, that would kind of help me to zero in on certain features that would reveal something with less effort than a lifetime that would show me something that says, aha, this is worth spending some more time with. And I think, you know, I think that's entirely possible. I also think that if it's real, you know, if what Terrence has come up with is real, then it's also more complex than he maybe appreciated this, but that he was able to express at
mm-hmm,
the time.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
And you know, what I would like to do, first of all, is, you know, given what we have in place, is see if there are some significant features that can say to me, aha, this is worth exploring further, John. And the fact of the matter is, Fourier analysis, and I brought that up only to sort of make people aware if there are actually ways of kind of extracting certain features. It is, again, it's like taking a spectrograph of a star or sun and pulling mm-hmm. out, well, this is hydrogen, and here's some helium and other elements are present. You can actually do that kind of thing right. with waveforms. And it turns out, though, that Fourier analysis for a fractal of this type isn't really the best way to go. There's another tool that actually Ralph Abraham made me aware of many years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another one of Terrence's gang.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, I was aware of it, but I was aware of it, but it was still then relatively new tool, you know, that was just starting to make its way onto the scene. And, you know, the tool is wavelets.
Hmm.
And it's really more suited, you know, to the type of waveform that the time wave represents. It's a little trickier to use. Fourier analysis by comparison is much more straightforward. But the interpretation of the Fourier spectrum is more difficult. If you know how to do wavelets properly, and you can either do what's called continuous wavelet transforms or discrete wavelet transforms. They both give you different types of information. But one should be able to use something like that on these waveforms to, in relatively short order, show features that one can then check against different periods in history to see if they show up.
Mm-hmm.
Do stock market crashes, for example, show up?
Right. And is it novel or is it habitual?
Yeah, exactly. Well, a stock market crash, I would say, you know, it's a breakdown of old forms.
Yes, okay.
You know, sort of.
So it's a novel thing, yeah.
Yeah, really, but you know, that's another thing one has to define.
Right. Yeah, you know, we were speaking. You mentioned Ralph, and I'm thinking of you know Rupert too. And I remember Rupert said one time that that the time wave required Terrence's personality to interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that aspect of it. But as you're mentioning now, this idea that Ralph came up with was a way to sort of eliminate that to a certain extent.
Well, I think my initial interest, you know, to begin with was, look, if he's onto something here, he's onto something big, all right? And if it's something big, then it's going to be expressible in more complex terms than what he has here. Although, as I mentioned, you know, it may have this is just sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it may have holographic properties. I mean, even a piece of something, even if you only have a piece of something, you should be able to kind of examine it in a way that'll tell you, well, this is an important piece.
That holographic idea, sort of.
Yeah. Well, you know, and
I
Rupert,
mean, in a fractal wave, right?
Yeah. Well, say that again.
I'm thinking of a holograph, how you can just get a little piece of it, you know, and it seems like the same idea with this fractal wave.
You know, that's part of the point. You know, just you know, do individual pieces contain some kind of image of the whole?
Mm.
You know, and I think people have probably heard this analogy more than once, but, you know, in a hologram, you can cut it up into as many pieces as you want, and each piece, no matter how small, still contains an image of the whole. The only thing that happens, as you get to smaller and smaller pieces, the image becomes more and more out of focus, or fuzzier and fuzzier.
Right, less clear, yeah.
And so, you know, we may be talking about something that's very fuzzy, and it's tricky and takes some skill and some talent to be able to kind of tease out, but I think it's, I've already done some work. I mean, basically, I haven't put this on my website yet, but it's one of the things that I want to get out there before I move, you know, my website's going to move out into my own domain at some point in the near future, but I wanted to kind of put together some new features of the time wave. So I've actually rewritten the software in another form, and included some mathematical tools that allow one to actually take a look at some of this stuff. And,
well,
you know, go ahead.
That's a great place for me to ask you about the individual side of this. Because, okay, well, first of all, is it something that will be available to people? In other words, the software that you're talking about, is it something that people can use actually?
I hope to make it available, yes.
Okay.
I do. But first... first cut, first order, it'll be something that I'll be able to post on the website. And I'd like to make it interactive. We'll see what happens with that. But if not interactive, updated regularly. I hope to make it somewhat interactive so people can play around with it.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I'd like to be able to make it available to people, you know, so others can play with it, explore it.
All right. Well, this is a thing now that you've been looking at and working on and thinking about for 15 years plus. So you obviously have considered it worthwhile that you know to continue looking at it. What do you make, John? And again, I say this sort of for individuals. In other words, should we be looking at the time wave as something that can be used as a tool in our own lives, or is it something that we should be looking at with regard to the supposed end date of it? You know, that corresponds to the rollover of the Mayan system. Or both, or what do you? I mean, I guess I'm just trying to find some purpose in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are two questions that I think any of us can ask of one another when we first meet that are more revealing about who and what we are than any other question you can ask, and that is, what gets your attention, and what stirs your passion and sense of wonder. So when you ask, you know, is it worthwhile? What makes? I mean, when people say, you know, and you hear people say, oh, that's a waste of time, you know, like, wait a minute, you'd be better off spending your time doing this or that or that. Well, nobody can really make that judgment. I mean, what is interesting to any one of us, you know, is, comes from a variety of places. And for me, you know, I'm an explorer. I love frontiers. The more alien, the better. You know? But I don't do it blindly, you know. There's something about this that is pulling me in, that's intriguing me. And I'm not, right now, frankly, up front, don't know quite what it is. But, you know, it has my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And it has my attention to the degree that I'm willing to explore this with the talents, you know, the skills, the tools that I have available, you know, to do that.
Well, you know, it has mine too, if it makes you feel any better.
And ultimately, I think it transcends, 2012. I think if there's something here, it's going to say something about the nature of what we're part of and what's part of us, which I think is more interesting and fundamental than the fact that 2012 might happen on 21st, 2012, et cetera, and all of the speculation as to what that might mean and all of that. For me, it's something that has to apply to my life in some significant way, not simply the life of the civilization necessarily as may be transformed and or whatever in 2012, but discovering, encountering, engaging a feature of life in the cosmos that tells me more about what and who we are, where we come from, where we're going, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, That's what's interesting to me about this, Can it show me something about myself and the nature of the cosmos at large that is meaningful to me? And I think for anybody, and I've had a number of people contact me over the years about, the whole idea and whether I had copies of the software, et cetera, who are interested in exploring this. I mean, it has, there are people that are interested in something about it, and I'm not quite sure what it is for other people, because they would have to tell me what gets their attention and stirs their passion and sense of wonder. But when something like this grabs my attention, I pay attention.
Right.
And I go with it to as far as I can until I've convinced myself that I've done as much as I can and I want, and it's time to move on to other things.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't reached that point here, because right from the get-go, I had several kinds of notions and questions about what this thing might be and how to explore it. I started down the road of complex systems theory and using some of the tools available with that to kind of explore it.
Mm-hmm.
Does the basic number set have fractal properties? Sure, there are fractal properties in the whole time wave, but that to some degree was constructed that way. If you go to the basic number sets, do they have fractal properties? I actually did some work on that before, Terence died, and saw that there's some Cantor-like fractal properties to the basic number set.
There's a person in the chat room who made a comment here who says, "I was screwing around with the software once. If you take a picture of the entire time wave from beginning to end and mirror it so it loops back around, it almost matches the Mandelbrot set."
Oh, really?
That's what he writes here. I thought that was interesting, so I thought I'd mention it there.
Yeah, that is interesting. I'll play with that and see what happens.
Anyway, so, well, I think that maybe, could we talk a little bit about looking at it as a, the I Ching was known as a divination tool, essentially, an oracle.
But what does that mean?
Well, I guess it means something to tell you about either something that's happening in your life or something that's going to happen.
Yeah. One of the questions, you hear these expressions thrown around, and I think, people have legitimate reasons for doing it, but it comes from, various people's perceptions of worldviews and perceptions of reality. A divination tool. Well, what does that mean, divination tool? It means, as I said before, it's a way of exploring perhaps hidden features of one's life experience.
Right.
And however this evolved, and I don't know that anybody knows specifically how the I Ching emerged or what it came from, but it's a fairly complex system. Certainly, it appears to be somewhat complex mathematically. Purports to actually have something meaningful to say about our life experience. And, you know, I've played with it. You know, as I said, you know, more often than not, I find it has something meaningful to say to me about my life experience.
Do you still throw the coins or do the arrow sticks and you still do the I Ching?
I'm lazy. the coins... You know, I've had friends say, you got to do the sticks. That's
no,
the way to do it.
I say, no way, do the coins.
But, you know, for me, I use the coins and I... But I see it, I also look at it... And probably thanks largely to Terrence and the fact that he was able to explore it in the way that he did. I also look at it in a mathematical sense and say, what am I and say to myself or ask myself, well, if this really is some science that we don't understand, as Terrence would like to say, then what are its mathematical features? How would that be expressed? You know, and what is the first order of number first order of difference number set relative to what is possible mathematically with this thing? So I look at it not only as sort of a personal way of affirming or exploring my own life process, but also can this be generalized, you know, in a way that, I mean, clearly it is generalized in the sense that there are, I don't know how many, but a good number of people out there who use it and feel or believe or sense that what they're gaining is relevant and meaningful for their life experience.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, if there's a collective connection with this, you know, can that collective connection be found in a mathematical expression that can be, you know, delineated and examined?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things, you know, that really, I think, maybe more than anything else connected me with Terrence was the fact that, you know, he had an extraordinarily uplifting, expansive worldview, you know, when it really comes down to it.
Yeah, he was as hopeful as they came.
Absolutely.
He really was, and he was misunderstood. A lot of people thought he was sort of a doom and gloomer. I'm like, no, Terrence was so hopeful, you know?
Absolutely. You weren't listening to the man, you know, And that's one of the things I shared with them. You know, I really shared that more expansive, uplifting, hopeful worldview. And that's why exploring these things, exploring in greater depth things like the I Ching that, you know, according to some are a simple product of somebody's mind and imagination, doesn't have any connection with, bearing on reality whatsoever. But that's just a you know, blanket statement that is based on personal feelings about what these things are and what they, you know, their relevance or irrelevance to human experience. Mm-hmm. I just take a different perspective, a different viewpoint. I think they're, as I said, we're buried, you know, we're immersed in this cosmic sea of information. Well, mm-hmm. How does that manifest at the level of consciousness, awareness, ideas, perspectives, worldviews, and all of that.
Right. Remarkable. All right, look, let's take one more short break here, okay? And we'll come back and we'll have another 25 minutes or so to sort of wrap things up. I got a couple more questions that I'd like to ask you. We've got some great comments and stuff popping up in the on the internet here. So let's take another breather here. I need to get a glass of water, and we'll come back and do a little bit more, okay?
Okay, Mike.
All right, John, thanks so much. All right, everybody, John Sheliak, Dr. John Sheliak on the web. Right now you can get to his site at www.kaileshs.home.comcast.net. That's the name, or the word, I should say, Sheliak. Just spell it backwards, though. kaileshs.home.comcast.net. And you can link over there from my site from here on out. And, plenty of stuff over there, actually, on John's site. I've been snooping around there for the last couple of weeks, and he has a load of stuff up there already, and I'm sure a whole lot more to come. So take a look over there at the website, and in the meantime, you should also listen to this piece of music here. I can't help playing it. It was so cool. I played it last week, but here's to my friends over there at ITOM Lab. Great stuff here. Back in just a minute. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Order.
The category under which this paper is included, Historical Problems, assumes the self-evidential thesis that there are elements of the gospel narratives which do not ring true. But any constructive analysis of the New Testament records can't rest content with the simple arithmetical equation fact equals the possible minus the less likely and downright impossible. That is, that if we go on peeling away the skins of improbability from the onion, we shall end eventually with a small kernel of historical fact on which to build some new theory. Could be distilled by skilled interpreters, well versed in the art of rabbinic exegesis, as well as the abracadabra of Gnostic mysticism. Secret passwords and sayings, the formulae for medicaments and hallucinatory drugs, the therapia in practice and prescription. Not everything that is true needs necessarily to be divulged to all men. The sacred mushroom and the cross, the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Christian myth, able to break open documentary seals, to terrify the world's rulers with its wrath. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the Christian myth. Sacred mushroom and the cross. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the Christian myth. In the scrolls to the Christian story, they are for the most part more likely to be in the nature of a common mythology. And to seek in the documents detailed correspondences of time, place, and persons is to misunderstand the nature of the Qumran texts and their authors' attitudes to history. Not everything that is true needs necessarily to be divulged to all men.
Not everything that is true need necessarily be divulged to all men. Ain't it the truth? ITOM Lab, that's Secret Messages, the John Allegro mix. Thanks so much for putting that together for us, and I just love it. Thanks, everyone. All right. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We've got Dr. John Sheliak on the line with us here from his place in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thanks so much for staying up late into the evening with us here, Dr. John.
My pleasure.
All right. Let's see. What was I going to say right before the break here? You know, I guess it comes down to today, real life, the world around us. In other words, the time wave is something that we've been looking at for quite a while now, and the theory's been around for 36 years, almost to the week, March 5th, the La Chirera, all that business happened 36 years ago, a week from today, essentially. What do you make of what you've seen, you know, since you've been involved? In other words, you know, what's personal experience telling you about the whole business?
About the time wave?
Yeah, and about what's happening on this planet.
Let me say something. One comment before that.
Please.
It has to do with this whole everything we're talking about now and why we're engaged in all of this, the criticisms and everything else that goes along with it. But, you know, Max Planck, one of the pioneers in quantum physics, once said that new ideas are not advanced by convincing the skeptic, but funeral by funeral. It means that new ideas, especially alien ideas, aren't very well accepted, you know. and usually takes people who are actually willing kind of stick with it, explore them, to move them forward, and time. Personally, you know, I have a number of friends who kind of play around with the particular versions that they have, and they find intriguing things in it.
Of the time wave software?
Yeah, I'm talking about time wave, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, that's kind of an interesting feature. But there's always been something more, you know. I sort of have convinced myself that to look beyond the time wave as it exists with the simple ebb and flow of novelty, as interesting as that can be, you know, there are enough people out there who can come up with features in history that don't correlate with the expected direction of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my answer to that is, of course, you know, you've got all of these processes happening together, and you know they're going to cause a certain amount of interference pattern.
Right. It's a matter of just the general trend, the overall weight this way or that way.
Right. But I'll tell you, and when I've convinced myself that there's something there, you know, I've actually done some recent exploration using wavelets.
Mm-hmm.
That are actually pretty intriguing and interesting in terms of what it shows.
Looking at the current time frame or the future? Or
both. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, basically what you have to, you know, initially what you have to do with this in order to explore it, you have to work with history because those are known things. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you know, they should show up in certain ways. Then once, you know, one is convinced that, okay, I have something here, mm-hmm. I'm going to look for this signature at this frequency at some period in time in the future to see if it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say the stock market crash of 29 had a big blip in this pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see what's going to happen in 2007. So I spread I spread 2007 out, take a look at it. Does this particular blip show up, you know, at this scale? And if so, when in 2007?
Mm-hmm.
Wait. Does it happen or not?
Right.
Or, you know, in my sense is that this isn't complete by a long shot. So there are going to be error bars in it. And those error bars are hard to judge. You know, it may be days, weeks, months, years.
Mm.
I don't know that yet. But what I've seen so far, you know, and again, this is just, this is very, very preliminary and, you know, may go out the window and down the tubes as I investigate further. But there's some interesting kind of patterns that are emerging around things like relativity, stock market, you know, war.
In 2007?
I haven't looked at 2007.
Oh, okay, okay.
But the patterns that show themselves up in history
I see.
Now, the next step, of course, is to see whether there's something like that that happens in 2007, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. But it's a fairly detailed process that one has to go through, you know. And before I would try to make any prediction with it, you know, I have to convince myself that it's rock solid in the past.
Right, you got a good match in the past. That's the whole
exactly
key, huh?
Right.
Okay. All right. All right, let me ask you a question that has come up here on the Internet, and I think I want to get to this before we run out of time here. Mike, can you ask Dr. Sheliak about other I Ching orders, like the Huang Ti order, etc.? Would these other orders perhaps make a clearer waveform better than the King Wen? There are other sequences, of course. So.
Yeah, I know. That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. I think it would have to be explored. You could do the same thing with any other sequence.
Right.
And as I said earlier...
My God, now that I think of that, it's just like probably this layered thing that's just outrageous, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, as I said earlier, I mean, this... If something real and meaningful here, it's the work of a lifetime.
Mm.
Of more than one person,
right?
So, you know, if someone has an interest in exploring that, that's, you know, certainly worth doing. The reason, you know, and people want to use all different number sets, and that's fine too. But I want to stay as true to whatever Terrence's vision was as I can, you know,
mm-hmm.
At least. Initially, you can use all kinds of number sets and play all kinds of games with these things. But I really want to try to stay true to what I thought and believed that Terrence's vision was related to this.
Right.
Stick with the King Wen sequence. You know, start with the first order of difference. And do it as cleanly in alignment with what I think he may have perceived. You know. And I hope, you know, it really is a tragic news to hear that, you know, his library has been burned.
Oh, Lord, you can't believe it, yeah.
And,
you know, the weird thing, I mean, there's a lot of weird things, but talk about resonant, time events and things like this. There was a really weird thing that happened in the Amazon. I don't know if you knew this or not, but back in 1971, when him and Dennis were embarking on this whole business, there was a strange fire that happened down there that burned a whole bunch of his notes and stuff. But 35 years ago, long before, you know, the books were written and all that stuff, the actual hard notes from some of the stuff that happened down there were burned in this real strange fire. And then all of a sudden now this happens again. And I have to think that we're in sort of a, and I'm saying this now just off the top of my head, but I have this intuition that right now we are in a resonant time well that's very, very similar to what was happening 35 or 36 years ago.
Yeah, there's a reactionary element to it, isn't there? You know, it's like...
Boy, it sure feels like it to me.
It's almost as though... Well, I don't think so. I mean, you can look around the culture and you can see enormous resistance to change and transformation going on, and it's, you know, entrenching itself more ferociously and intensely every day, every week. Whether you can say this is, you know, part of that process or not, it's hard to tell. But certainly, it feels like some kind of resistance to new and likely transforming memes and ideas and notions and philosophies.
Right. I mean, and it's you know, with what the things we were talking about earlier. I mean, just the things that you're involved with, you know, laser fusion devices and all these other things. I mean, the whole world is going psychedelic, you know,
uh-huh.
And it seems like, you know, how can it be stopped? Almost. I mean, whatever's coming is like a gigantic wave, and I mean, if you think you're going to stop it, it just seems like that. Seems foolish. It's just a matter of either trying to ride it or figure out where it's going to go or where it's going to lead us, or is it going to smash us, or what's going to happen, you know?
Well, you know, my personal philosophy in the face of all of this is just, and I've kind of written some of this on the website now, is, you know, be quiet, possible or necessary, pay attention to what's going on within and without, and you know, do my best to engage the world consciously, openly, honestly, and not try to overlay my will or desire on that process. You know, I don't think any one of us can have a serious impact on the evolution of planet Earth and her civilization, but we all have our place and our part. You know, I'm not big on reward punishment kinds of scenarios that go along with the cosmos and life and all of that. But along the way, I really, really began to feel like if there's anything that whatever the creative organizing principle of the cosmos is will hold me accountable for, it's what I do with my gifts, talents, abilities, skills, you know, during this lifetime. You know, each of us, I think, has an obligation, a moral obligation, to express who and what we are in the world as best we can. Mm. You know, and let history, the world, and everything else, you know, make commentary on that. But as the expression goes, if not now, when? If not us, who?
Who? Yeah. Man. Yeah, now more than ever, it seems like, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I would say so.
Well, I've snooped around the website, and I notice a couple of interesting links. One of them is over to the Resonance Project.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Nassim Haramein. I've interviewed him. I don't know if you knew that, but...
I didn't know that you interviewed him, no.
Yeah, and Michael Heisen, who's a marine biologist who's a friend and a co-conspirator of Nassim, is doing some work there right now, as a matter of fact, in Hawaii. And anyway, I just saw that on your site, and I thought it was interesting. What's your connection to those people?
Oh, I met Nassim in Santa Fe. Well, it wasn't in Santa Fe. It was just south of Albuquerque a few years ago. I was part of this dance group. One person of whom was a personal friend of his partner, mm-hmm. his partner. And he was in Albuquerque for some type of astrophysical meeting, mm-hmm. gave a paper. And she arranged him to give a sort of abbreviated version of his general talk that he did at the time at workshops or whatever he was doing on a Friday evening, so I decided to go to check it out. And a case like Terence. I was intrigued by what he had to say and how he had to say it. He gave a pretty polished presentation of his theories related to black holes, the cosmos, and, you know, basically what Nassim is about is the holy grail of physics, right? The grand unification.
Right.
but he had a very unique approach, which intrigued me. And that's, I mean, most grand unification is going about like string theory, you know, it's, you know, using hyperdimensional space to kind of unify things and a variety of other ways of doing it, parallel universes, et cetera, et cetera. But Nassim's approach was uniquely different and intrigued me, and it was patterns. What was interesting about his ideas is that they were about patterns in nature and the cosmos. In other words, let's step back from the equations and look at patterns, not simply patterns that they emerge from equations in physics, science, or math, but patterns in nature,
mm-hmm.
crop circles, yeah. I Ching, Kabbalah,
orbital
star
spins,
cluster, you know, gravitational fields.
Yeah.
What do they have in common? And that just intrigued me, actually. So we had a number of conversations after that and then kind of lost touch. But I was aware that he was doing this and really wanted to kind of make people aware of the fact that he may be doing some interesting stuff.
Yeah, it is. And his partner is this Elizabeth Rauscher. And she's done some really good work, I think, in the past.
Absolutely.
Too, so.
She's very well known.
All right. So, anyway, okay. Well, great. What else? We've got about five more minutes, I guess. There's sort of a general question that's arisen in my email, actually, and people just sort of saying, well, it seems like the consensus is that novelty does seem to be increasing. People seem to be saying that, well, it's obvious if you look around us that things are getting more complicated. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I guess, what do we do? I mean, people are just sort of saying, well, look, if nobody's in control, and it is the, you know, the runaway freight train on a dark and stormy night, what are we to do?
Well, you know, for me it comes down to consciousness, you know, and consciousness is not a state, you know. Like, for me, happiness is not a state. Love is not a state. There's nothing in the cosmos that we know of that's static. Everything is a dynamic process. Consciousness is a dynamic process. And what that means for me is that it's an increasing awareness of the nature, of my nature, and the nature of what I'm a part of, and the development of the skills necessary to engage that, interact with it, integrate it into my life process so that I become a more integrated person, being, and live from that place. And I think that's what all of these things are really about. You know, what can I, you know, forget about the time wave. You know, how is my life unfolding? You know?
Mm-hmm.
How is my life unfolding day to day? Is it increasing the level of integration in for the different parts of my experienced life and the people around me? Is that increasing? Is there something extraordinary going on here? I mean, dreams and dream time have been an important part of my life process as far back as I can remember.
Yeah, you have a section on the website about dreams.
Yeah, and they've, by and large, and for the most part, have affirmed and supported, you know, an extraordinary view of the nature of what we're part of and what's part of us. And I think, you know, for each of us just to be able to pay attention to that process within oneself and then, you know, make connections with others, explore that. I think the more aware we are of our own nature and the nature of what we're a part of, the more we're able to interact with it, engage it in ever more conscious and compassionate ways.
Hmm.
I mean, the world needs people who have an expanding awareness that has them interact and engage the world around them in more integrated, holistic, compassionate ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of these things can help us get there. I mean, this one dream, and I won't go into the details, you know, but it was a dream, interdimensional travel and a variety of other things, but it ended up in this building, you know, that was something you might see in early Colorado, you know. It was a wooden building, but it was a huge wooden building, brand new.
Right.
I walk inside, and it's filled with the doings of this civilization. Everything that you can possibly imagine has been created from the minds and imaginations of human beings on planet Earth was in that building. And there was I had this sense of reverence when I looked at it. I mean, it was really amazing kind of feeling. There was a young man behind me who wanted to start collecting it. There's a lot of valuable stuff there. He just wanted to collect and, you know, make a profit from it. And I knew this was a no-no in the dream, so I turned to him and I said, no.
Mm-hmm.
We can't take any of this with us. You know, these things are here for our learning, but they must stay here.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I said that, a voice said to me, and I don't hear voices. Every once in a while in dreams, you know, this will happen. It said, as simple as this, John, everything is just fine. In fact, it's more fine than you can possibly imagine. That went to the core of my being. I mean, I really heard that in ways that go beyond just listening to it. You know, it reached into my soul in some fundamental way and grabbed me and showed me some fundamental truth. And I think, from my perspective, engaging things like the I Ching or the time wave, they're about that process. They're not about the specific, necessarily the specific predictions. And people tend to focus on that, just like they focus on personalities. They're about what can happen with us and to us when we engage these things in open-hearted, open-minded ways.
Well, that is about as good a way as any as I can think to close the program. Wonderful, wonderful stuff, John.
Thank you, Michael.
Remarkable. All right. Well, look, we got about 5 minutes for me to wrap things up here, so I'm going to say goodbye. We're going to have to do it again, and we're going to keep watching things as things move forward. I mean, it's just a remarkable time to be alive, John.
It is. You know, it is. We're really gifted, you know, in that respect.
It really is something else. You know, I'll say one more thing, and maybe you can comment really quickly. I think of what you just said and about the responsibility sort of that we have. In other words, our ancestors, you know, the people put a date on it, 3 million years, 1 million years, whatever, however far back you want to go. What they went through to get us here, you know,
right.
And here we are. And if we drop the ball,
right.
You know, it's really a shame because
it's tragic.
It's just a tragedy. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing to help us try to not do that, you know.
Well, thank you, Mike, for having me. I really enjoyed talking with you tonight.
All right. Well, keep up the great work. We'll be in touch, and I'll talk to you again, okay?
Thank you.
All right, John. Take care of yourself.
Take care.
Everybody, Dr. John Szeliak, one more time on the web at it's Szeliak backwards. And where did I go with my link? There it is, kaileh.home.comcast.net. And if you didn't write that down because it's 2 in the morning, you can just go to my website and link over there from here on out, okay? So big thank you one more time to Dr. John Szeliak, doing great work and has been for a very long time. So keep your eye on him, and we'll be in touch and hopefully have Dr. John back on the program here sometime in the future. A big thank you to the Cotton Mollies, Sorcerer, Ism, Revolve, the musical guests for tonight. And we'll be back next week at you with Ralph Metzner. Okay? Wish me luck. I'm on the road for the next week or so. And we'll expect to be back here and have a great time with Dr. Ralph Metzner and Noah Earle next week. Okay? Stick around. You got Ruth coming to play some wonderful music for you. And, well, I'll talk to you all later. All right? Take care of yourself. This is one more from Sorcerer. And a big thank you one more time to Dr. John Szeliak. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit. I'll catch you all next week. Thank you.
truth.